White Network presents Hitler's Table Talk, Study Out. Reading and commentary on the after-dinner monologues delivered by Adolf Hitler from 1941 to 1944 and transcribed by AIDS.
Good evening and good day, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It's hard to tell these days whether it's hard to say good evening when it's still so light out here, and I'm sure I know it's the same where Ray is, so, you know, and in the West Coast it'd really be early, so... I should be saying good. I don't know what to say. But anyway, it's April 10th today and 2014, and this is episode 6, and I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And Ray, we have got a really good, some really good things to read tonight, don't we? And,
yes, we do.
And there's a lot to say about it, so I don't know how far we're going to get. And on top of that, we wanted to go back over a little bit the last section that you read last week at the end. And before we do that, I wanted to say something about the use of Untermenschen from last week's program. And as I listened to it today, because I was listening to, I was cooking and I was, looking for something to listen to, and I didn't find anything that I liked, so I turned to our program from last week again and listened to it. And I heard that, and it kind of bothered me the way I was talking about it. You know, I didn't think I did a good job at all. And I would like to say that this, if the word in the text was Untermenschen, or if it was just translated, you know, I don't know how it was translated, but it's that simply means a lower type of human being that's not up to German standards, as in, you know, they were talking about criminals. So if you're a criminal, and Hitler was saying, well, this every day some German is murdered in Germany by some, you know, animal, and then he called him that word. And that would be, you know, a human being that is not up to the standards that we would expect, and certainly not up to National Socialist standards. So it shouldn't be taken literally as someone who's subhuman or less than human. That phrase, you know, that has too much has been made out of that, and it's not really, you know, what does subhuman mean? Does it mean you're? They like to accuse the National Socialists of thinking that way. And then he said, he called the criminals that, and then he said that, that the Soviet POWs were no better. And, in some places, I think it's in tonight, it might be in tonight, he calls the Russians brutes. Was that in tonight?
Yes.
Or was I reading ahead? And, you know, if we think in terms of, and this was before this happened, but if we think in terms of what they did at the end of the war, in the coming into German-occupied territory and then raping all those women and raping seven-year-old girls, sometimes, you know, they died because they were raped multiple times, and old women, and, you know, and this is all known to be fact. Well, I don't know what you'd call that. There is some kind of brutish element there, for sure. And it shouldn't be downplayed, but people should understand what Hitler was aware of as the head of his country and getting all the intelligence and all the information, and why he would say things like that. So I don't want to, you know, it sounds almost like I'm wanting to repeat that all these Russians are terrible, but that's where it wasn't my intention. My intention was to kind of, explain why things that are said are being said. But then, I guess I better just leave it at that if I don't seem to make things worse here. So, all right, let's, okay, we were gonna, what would you like to say about last week's, section, which is, I'll just give those little, what it was about, the Czechs and Bolshevism, a Hohenzollern mistake, the Habsburgs, the foreign dynasty in the generation of 1900. It was really pretty short.
Right, right. Yeah. But there's a lot of into that, and where he mentions the Czechs are the people who would be most upset by the decline of Bolshevism, for it's they who have always looked with secret hope towards Mother Russia. Well, of course, Czechoslovakia arose out of the settlement of World War I, and it was an artificially created state with designs to give any foreign enemy, especially the Soviets, a path of invasion right into Germany. And they knew that they had a friend with the Czechoslovak leaders for that purpose. And so it makes perfect sense that he says they've always looked with secret hope towards Mother Russia. They're going to be the ones disgusted or upset by the decline of Bolshevism. And he,
well, I don't know if they loved Bolshevism, do you? But
they looked to
Russia, I guess, as their, as their ally.
Yeah. And the Russia, the symbol of Bolshevism, of course.
Yeah.
And then he mentions when we learned about the fall of Port Arthur, he's talking about the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. He says the little Czechs in my class at school wept while the rest of us exulted. It was then that my feeling for Japan was born. And you know, it's like right there, Carolyn, to me, he's celebrating the triumph of the Japanese people over, what adjective I would put on the Russians there, but you know, that's I think it was a perfectly natural reaction for him.
Well, you know, he didn't like Czechs because he was in Austria. It wasn't back when he was in school. He said this was back in his school days, you know, as a young. We're still the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Mm-hmm. And it was multicultural. And
yes.
It was mixed German and Slavic, various Slavic groups. And supposedly they all got along all right. Well, it was a well-run empire and made sure that everybody got their due pretty well, you know. And, but he didn't like it. And when he was older and he went to Vienna and then he was interested in politics and he went to the parliament because that was the capital of the Austrian part of the empire. And, he said he had these high expectations. He thought he was going into some, you know, he had a real, respectful attitude going in to see what the actual parliament of the country was doing, and he said he was shocked and horrified at the arguing and bickering and so on that went on. And one thing he said was that these different groups, and one of them was the Czechs that he mentioned, would get up and give talks in their own language, and the other people didn't understand their language or, you know, would walk out and nobody was listening to anybody else, and they were all doing this kind of thing. And he said it was just a mess and no work for the state could get done in such an environment. So he didn't like multiculturalism ever. He wanted Austria to then be German. He actually wanted to go to Germany. He just didn't like the empire, and he didn't like the Habsburgs either.
Right.
So then
right.
He goes on to talk about the Hohenzollerns and the Habsburg monarchy. And, you know, I was trying to figure out what he meant here. And I'm not sure I'm right, but I think that he's saying that the Hohenzollerns should have allowed the Austria to, shouldn't have gone to the rescue of Austria when the First World War was breaking out. That's what I get out of it. I could be wrong, though, because the Hohenzollerns were a noble family that was German. They were had their dynasty in Brandenburg. This thing keeps getting in my way from these. Brandenburg, Prussia, Germany, and Romania. They were the royal family in all four of those independent kind of states at that time. And they were originated in Swabia, which is where Colonel Stauffenberg came from. And he saw them as a more German-type royal family, and he sees the Habsburgs, as he says, as foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
What did he call them? He said they were. He always saw them as
a foreign dynasty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think he was saying that there was no need to go, because he said somewhere else. There was no need to go to. He says that once a dynasty adopts the safeguarding of peace at any price. And here's the other thing I think that he was referring to. The maintenance of undue consideration for the feelings of other foreign dynasties. So do you think that could be what he means? That Germany, the Hohenzollern should have influenced Germany not to go and defend, Austria and the Habsburgs in that argument, which ended up going, you know, turning into World War One. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was their fault, because World War One was trying to be instigated anyway. So let's not forget that. But still,
I think you're onto something there, Caroline. I think it's a very good point. It's like you said a while ago, when he went to observe, let's just say, Parliament or the operation of the government, what he saw was a three-ring Babylonian circus. Mm-hmm. And the multicultural aspect of it was disgusting to him, and they never would get anything done. It was always an organization working against itself, and I think because of that viewpoint that he had, he didn't figure it was worth spilling Hohenzollern blood over, German blood over it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although he seemed to like the war, he liked being a soldier. Mm-hmm. Very much, and he was enthusiastic about the war. That's what I always read. So I was just wondering about what he's saying here. And then he says that, he's even grateful to the Social Democrats for having gotten rid of the royalty, which is what they did, you know, at the end of the war. And a lot of people see that as a bad thing, as a tragedy. They took the Kaiser off his throne and got rid of the monarchy, and then they had this horrible social liberal government. But Hitler is saying that he didn't like the monarchy and he didn't care much for the Kaiser, and he's glad that they did that, because I've spent some time reading about and trying to figure, you know, clarify what his position was right at the end of the war, when he remained in the army and was in the barracks, when a lot of this joining up the right wing, I don't know what to call it, the nationalists or something, mm-hmm. were joining and creating the Freikorps and so on. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't a part of that. And he seemed to be observing, because he did have a sympathy for socialism. And his concern was for the working German man and woman, you know, mm-hmm. mostly the man. The German workers, and he didn't like the elites. And so he was kind of holding off there. And for that reason, people will say that, oh, he was a communist. He's always been one. He was, you know, working for the communists and then the Zionists and all this stuff, which isn't true. But it does show that he was sympathetic with the working man, and he was wondering how these Social Democrats were going to do, and even these people, whatever they, I think some of them were Jews, but they weren't all Jews, were going to do. But eventually he started working kind of like as a spy observer for his infantry mm-hmm. group, and then he went to that meeting to see what it was all about, kind of like as an agent checking it out, you know, for the military there that he was still attached to, of that workers party. And then yeah. he thought that was pretty good, and that's where everything started. But he's saying all this here, you know, in a very few words.
That's right.
But that he was not a monarchist at all, and he also didn't like the way that the Kaiser. I've always had a lot of kind of sympathy for the Kaiser and all that, but mm-hmm. I don't know that much about it. But he says that. Where did I go? That the Kaiser didn't treat Bismarck right, and Bismarck he sees as the founder of the Reich, and he said Kaiser should have been more respectful to Bismarck as the founder of the Reich, so he didn't have any love for the Kaiser,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and any of that. So that's, I think, you know, in that little short part there tells us a lot.
Oh yeah, and he closes. That part is closed with we have seen what a people is capable of when it's led. All mm-hmm. possibilities exist in it for good as well as evil. And then this key tenet of National Socialism is mentioned last here. The duty of National Socialism inevitably boils down to this. All that is best in the people should be allowed ceaselessly to develop. You know, that right there, I don't know, I interpret that like I've always seen National Socialism as a middle class movement. It's certainly not elitist, and we know how, you just mentioned how Hitler felt about the elite, and it wasn't a lower class movement as Bolshevism was, the masses stirred up, and things like this. And, mm-hmm. and then him saying that, if you got excellent, if you got talented, good people, don't measure them by their birth, right, or their money. I think that's a key to why his movement really was able to overcome Bolshevism.
Yeah, but now you mentioned the middle class. Well, you have to be a little careful because he made it clear that he didn't like the bourgeoisie.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were kind of the supporters of the monarchy. And he was probably more inclined to the workers,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't. But he hated communism and Bolshevism.
Sure.
Because the one thing, they were international, you know, and he
yes.
told, you know, could see through that.
That's right.
So, but you're right. You know, this saying that all people should be allowed ceaselessly to develop is a populist idea. It's not an elitist idea. So, you know, he cannot be, the National Socialist idea can't be put into little peg holes that easily. It encompasses a lot because it was to bring together all the German people. So it couldn't be just one part, and it certainly was not interested in creating a class divisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, well, okay, let's get started and,
okay.
Would you please read the first sections?
Certainly,
certainly. Right.
Yeah, this the night of the 22nd and 23rd of September 1941, and in reading this very first part here, Carolyn, I couldn't help but think of the movie Titanic, and I think you'll see the comparison here. It's terrifying to think that only a few years ago such discriminations could have existed on our great transatlantic liners in the treatment of passengers of different classes. It's inconceivable that nobody was embarrassed so to expose the difference between the various conditions of life. There we have a field in which the labor front will find a chance to make itself useful. In the East, on the railway, all Germans will have to travel first or second class so as to distinguish themselves from the natives. The difference between the first and second will be that one will have three places on each side, the other four. I think it's an excellent idea to have introduced a single style of messing throughout the army. Already during the First World War, the messing for the troops was much better when the officers used it too. I don't see the point of an uninterrupted succession of dishes, such as used to be the rule. One is afflicted the whole evening with the same female neighbor when one would have preferred to entertain oneself with other fellow guests. It's impossible to eat enough of what one likes, and the other dishes are boring. For party receptions, the best notion is the cold buffet. Kindred spirits form groups. You can change places to chat and move from one companion to another. This notion also puts an end to the competition for the places of honor, such as is required by the classical method of arranging the table.
Well, I thought that was so funny because there, you know, he comments on everything.
That's right.
And now here, you know, it's like, well, the upper classes, and when you go to these dinners put on by wealthy people, which I suppose he's been to some, and he just thinks that he hates that because you have to sit there all evening with that same woman next to you that you're forced to chat with, you know, and that's true. And then they have all these courses. And they bring one course after another, which to make the thing last a couple of hours. And he's just being so practical. He doesn't like all those different things. He likes certain things, and he wants to be able to eat what he likes, and not have all those others that he's not interested in. But he doesn't get enough of what he likes because you know you get a little bit of each thing.
Yeah, it's too much pompous and putting on airs.
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they're impressing. I guess the more courses they can come up with and the more different and varied dishes, the more that they think they're impressing all the other people. And, right. He didn't have any use for any of that. And he likes the buffet where people can then, move around and move from one person to another, you know, and talk with who you want and eat what you want. eat the things you like and not the things you don't like. So I just thought that was funny.
Sure.
All right.
23rd of September, 1941, evening. It's absurd to try to suppose that the frontier between the two separate worlds of Europe and Asia is marked by a chain of not very high mountains, and the long chain of the Urals is no more than that. One might just as well decree that the frontier is marked by one of the great Russian rivers. No, geographically, Asia penetrates into Europe without any sharp break. The real frontier is the one that separates the Germanic world from the Slav world. It's our duty to place it where we want it, where we want it to be. If anyone asks us where we obtain the right to extend Germanic space to the east, we reply that for a nation, her awareness of what she represents carries this right with it. It's success that justifies everything. The reply to such a question can only be of an empirical nature. And I'm going to stop right there, Carolyn, because that particular statement right there, for a nation, her awareness of what she represents carries this right with it.
Yeah,
this is a perfect example of what in American history is titled Manifest Destiny, a racial imperative. And then let me go on here. It's inconceivable.
It's interesting that you bring up Manifest Destiny because somebody brought it up. Franklin Reichardt brought it up on a long back and forth we were having. He was saying he disapproves of Hitler and the Third Reich and what it did in Eastern Europe, and saying that Hitler himself noticed that similarity between his ideas and Manifest Destiny in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel about Manifest Destiny? Of course, it's got a bad rap today. You're not supposed
to approve
of it.
Sure it does. I think it was absolutely meant to be, and it had to be if there was ever going to be any advancing of civilization. And and I think that he defines that in the next paragraph. But, yes, okay. To me, it's a definite racial imperative.
Well, I like that he says a nation's awareness of what she represents carries a right to do what it thinks it should do.
Yes.
I like that because nations that don't, I think he's kind of contrasting it to nations that don't have any clear awareness of themselves and what they want and what they, I like what he said that word represents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you are. And what you are, I don't know how else to, what other words to use to say that differently. You're right, it is the same as Manifest. It's like, you decide that this is right, this is what you should do, it's good for you, but plus you have a higher level of being there in understanding all that, and so you just go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm. And that was the American mindset back in that day and time. The leadership of the nation felt mm-hmm. that very thing, and no guilt complex with it.
Yeah. Oh, I just know that they just say now, oh, it was so terrible to have such ideas like mm-hmm. that. Oh, God. All right, go on.
Okay. It's inconceivable that a higher people should painfully exist on a soil too narrow for it, whilst amorphous masses, which contribute nothing to civilization, occupy infinite tracts of a soil that is one of the richest in the world. We painfully rest a few meters from the sea. We torment ourselves cultivating marshes. And in the Ukraine, an inexhaustibly fertile soil with a thickness in places of 10 meters of humus lies waiting for us. We must create conditions for our people that favor its multiplication, and we must at the same time build a dike against the Russian flood. If this war had not taken place, the Reich would scarcely have increased its population during the next 10 years, but the Russian population would have grown vigorously. The earth continues to go round, whether it's the man who kills the tiger or the tiger who eats the man. The stronger asserts his will. It's the law of nature. The world doesn't change. Its laws are eternal. There are some who say the world is evil and that they wish to depart from this life. For my part, I like the world. Unless the desire is to die is due to a lover's quarrel, I advise the desperate man to have patience for a year. The consolations will come. But if a human being has any other reason to wish to die than this, then let him die. I'm not stopping him. I merely call attention to the fact that one cannot escape this world entirely. The elements of which our body is made belong to the cycle of nature. And as for our soul, it's possible that it might return to limbo until it gets an opportunity to reincarnate itself. But it would vex me if everybody wanted to have done with life. To make death easier for people, the church holds out to them the bait of a better world. We, for our part, confine ourselves to asking man to fashion his life worthily. For this, it is sufficient for him to comfort to the laws of nature.
To conform
to the laws of nature. Let's seek inspiration in these principles, and in the long run, we'll triumph over religion. But there will never be any possibility of National Socialism setting out to ape religion by establishing a form of worship. Its one ambition must be scientifically to construct a doctrine that is nothing more than an homage to reason. Our duty is to teach men to see whatever is lovely and truly wonderful in life and not to become prematurely ill-tempered and spiteful. We wish fully to enjoy what is beautiful, to cling to it, and to avoid as far as possible anything that might do harm to people like ourselves. If today you do harm the Russians, it is so as to avoid giving them the opportunity of doing harm to us. God does not act differently. He suddenly hurls the masses of humanity onto the earth, and he leaves it to each one to work out his own salvation. Men dispossess one another, and one perceives that at the end of it all, it's always the stronger who triumphs. Is that not the most reasonable order of things? And there's your manifest destiny again. If it were otherwise, nothing good would ever have existed. If we did not respect the laws of nature, imposing our will by the right of the stronger, a day would come when the wild animals would once again devour us. Then the insects would eat the wild animals, and finally, nothing would exist on Earth but the microbes.
Well, that's typical Hitler talk, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, this comes up in other places. This is not something that's unlike him. It's very much like him. Boy, I've got so many comments to this, mm-hmm. But the obvious ones I won't do. But I mean, I just have to point out that he said the real frontier is the one that separates the Germanic world mm-hmm. from the Slav world, which indicates certainly that he saw them as separate, that he saw them at least as different or that could be separated. Today, I guess that's considered that we could all be that in white nationalism. I shouldn't even bring that up because it's not really relevant to what's here. So I'm not even going to bring that up. But and then you were talking about the other. We already talked about that. And he talks about our people. We must create conditions for our people. He definitely favors his own people.
Certainly.
No question about it. Mm-hmm. And wants his own people to multiply and talks about building a dike against the Russian flood, although that would very much be the Bolshevik flood, right? That I think that's what he has in mind there. He's points out the stronger asserts his will, it's the law of nature. He went very much by that law of nature. I suppose somebody could say, well, he was justifying what he did by using that. I think he really saw it. Well, he says something further on that I don't know if we're going to get to that or not, but which makes a point, which makes this more understandable. It said what he experienced in World War I. Which gave him his world view that he's had now started, gave him a good part of it. And then I have to say where he brought up reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Now that in a way he says, the elements of our body belong to nature. Mm-hmm. But as for our soul, it's possible that it might return to limbo. That is a state of just, existing.
Mm-hmm.
And then gets an opportunity to reincarnate itself. Now, he says that without any thought. It doesn't sound like he finds that strange or mm-hmm. anything like that, but he's not pushing the idea. But he sees that as, that's what I see as the best possibility of mm-hmm. of what we do.
Sure.
So that means, whatever, which it's so intelligent because whatever we're doing in the world, in our own life, we can't escape it because we're going to come back. And people will say, well, you don't have to, don't come back. I think, you don't have to if you don't want to, but I think what happens is that most, souls want to, you have a different viewpoint when you're mm-hmm. outside of this body in this world at the time, and then you want to come back because that's where everything's happening in the physical universe. So now I just found I never saw him ever say anything like that before, so I found that really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course the church again, it's he prefers the law of nature to the church religion, prefers what he's just already said, to the idea of, that you're working in this life to get into the best position you can in heaven, in your heavenly life. So, whatever you do now will determine that for you. He doesn't go along with that. And again, here where he says there will never be any possibility of national socialism setting out to establish to ape religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I had read on my program Saturday his 1938 speech at the Nuremberg Party Day, in which I read a section from that speech in which he was saying that very clearly. He also spoke against occultism or I don't know any of that kind of stuff. But he also said that National Socialism didn't want to be worshipped and was never going to establish itself as like some kind of a religion. That it itself would be a religion. And there are people who think that would be a good idea to make it a religion. But he was very much against that.
Right.
So, and that's it. So do you have anything more you want to say about that?
Yeah, I think it's very pertinent to mention here where he says, where God hurls the masses of humanity onto the earth and leaves it to each one of them to work out its own salvation. Men dispossess one another. And he says that just matter-of-factly. That's the way it is. And one perceives that at the end of it all, it's always the stronger who triumphs. Now, this great, you know, cry against manifest destiny and these evil white tribe of people that swept the poor red man and stole his land and all of this stuff, infuriates me because it's putting a modern mindset that's been tampered with in position to that a position that they're judging the things that happened back then. And of course, when our European ancestors came to this country and began the move west, they did encounter the other race, the red race. And overwhelmingly, the red race was a nomadic people. They were not settled in as farmers. They moved, they followed the buffalo, they followed the seasons, and they usually had the same route. And of course, when the white man moved to the west and wanted some land and settled the land, they picked the best they could find, the one closest to a water supply, and things like this. And then maybe 5-6 months later, here comes that tribe of Indians, and they look and there's someone on the land where they would pick the camp and stay for a while on their journey, and here's someone occupying it. So you have two totally different people here. The white man didn't come steal the Indian's land. There was no Indian on that section at the time. Mm-hmm. And they settled it and tried to cultivate it and whatever. Then along comes the Indian, and there's the massacres and things like this. So this whole thing has been so misrepresented with the noble savage, the evil whites, and stealing of the land and things like this. And certainly we both know there were atrocities, and there was theft and mistreatment and things like this. But that is a part of what he says here. It's always the stronger who triumphs, and right, they dispossess one another.
Well, if the white people hadn't triumphed, the Indians would have triumphed over them, and they wouldn't,
yes,
have had any mercy.
<That's>
and they
exactly
wouldn't have
right.
felt bad about it whatsoever. They never would have had any guilt. It's just us that gets into this guilt thing. Well, you know, I believe Adolf Hitler would have was totally approved of what,
sure,
of what
sure
we did colonizing.
Because it was in the man. Natural order of things. And in his right. statement here, if it were otherwise, nothing good would ever have existed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, that's definitely, and people should, if they don't already understand that about Hitler's mindset, they should mm-hmm. understand it because mm-hmm. it's very, very important. And he never said otherwise, you know. He started with this early in Mein Kampf, these ideas, and they, mm-hmm. they continued on. And here it's 1941, he's still
right.
saying them.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's one of his, basic things. Okay, well, why don't you read that next
okay.
one, and then I'll read.
Okay. 25th September, 1941, midday. What is surprising about the Russian rulers is the fanaticism with which they adhere to a principle, perhaps a correct principle in itself, even when it has become evident that the principle has ceased to be correct in fact. The explanation is their fear of having to accept responsibility for a failure. For they never suffer failure because of a weakness in their command, a shortage of ammunition, or an irresistible German pressure. It's always because of an act of treachery. They never produce any other explanation but treachery. And every commander of a unit who has not succeeded in conformity with the orders he has received runs the risk of having his head chopped off, so they prefer to be wiped out by us. On the other hand, the offensive spirit that inspires the Russian when he is advancing does not surprise us. It was the same during the First World War, and the explanation for it is their bottomless stupidity. We've forgotten the bitter tenacity with which the Russians fought us during the First World War. In the same way, coming generations will see in the campaign now in progress only the magnificent operation that it will have been. without giving any more thought to the numerous crises that we had to overcome by reason of this tenacity. We knew during the First World War a type of Russian combatant who was more good-natured than cruel. Nowadays, this type no longer exists. Bolshevism has completely wiped it out. Asia, what a disquieting reservoir of men. The safety of Europe will not be assured until we have driven Asia back behind the Urals. No organized Russian state must be allowed to exist west of that line. They are brutes, and neither Bolshevism nor Tsarism makes any difference. They are brutes in a state of nature. The danger would be still greater if this space were to be Mongolized. Suddenly a wave comes foaming down from Asia and surprises a Europe benumbed by civilization and deceived by the illusion of collective security. Since there is no natural protection against a flood, we must meet it with a living wall. A permanent state of war on the Eastern Front will help to form a sound race of men and will prevent us from relapsing into the softness of a Europe thrown back upon itself. The points we have reached are dotted along areas that have retained the memory of Germanic expansion. We've been before at the Iron Gates, at Belgrade, in the Russian space. The German past, in its totality, constitutes our own patrimony, whatever may be the dynasty, whatever may be the stock from which we arise. It is important to bring together in the German pantheon all the glories of Germany's past, as Ludwig I did in the eyes of the whole world. As regards myself, I shall never live to see it, but one day my successors must be in a position to bring out from a drawer every historical date that justifies a German claim. Once our position is consolidated, we shall be able in this sphere to go back as far as the Great Invasion. Berlin must be the true center of Europe, a capital that for everybody shall be the capital.
Well, you know, there's no doubt. I mean, there's no doubt he's 100% for Germany. He thinks that's Germany deserves that. He thinks he thinks the Germans are the best, and he thinks that they should be, you know, have have kind of a rulership. You know, using that word ruler, I was thinking that. Oh, I had a good thought today about that. We talk about. I guess in politics, you know, we talk about in a nation, a political party rules, you know, whoever wins the elections, then they rule. And yet when we, I feel like, see, it's probably just me. I feel like when I say that Hitler believed the Germans should rule, then right away I just feel all this criticism and anger coming at me or something, you know, that oh, what makes you think that, if somebody, you know, talking about German arrogance and so on. Well, you know, it was either that or Germany being destroyed by its enemies, really, and not necessarily the Russians. It was the British and the Jews and the Americans and so on that wanted to keep Germany weak and had treated Germany terribly. So he was trying. He had been having success with it, so he's continuing on with getting German strength and dominance, so that it wouldn't be so easy to do to Germany what they had done in the past. But when he's talking about the you notice he says that the Russian before Bolshevism was a good-natured soldier and so on.
Yes.
And so when he talks about these horrible Russians, or he talks about the brutes and so on, I would say that he's seeing it as a Bolshevist, because it's always Bolshevism that he was against, not so much the Russians. So, but they were hosting the. They were hosting the Jews there. They had the revolution there. So
that's
what
right.
did you do?
That's right.
Now, I'm moving around here. I'm losing my place. Oh yeah, this. Well, I had to look up the gates of the Iron Gates, and that has to do with Hungary. It's the siege of Belgrade in 1456. Mm-hmm. But it was Hungary versus the Ottoman Turks. So I guess Hungary was kind of, well, at that time, the Austro-Hungarian, I don't know if that was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but the, you know, the Yugoslavian, what became Yugoslavia was a part of Hungary, I think. Mm-hmm. So they had control of Belgrade. And, he brings that up that they've been through all this before in their expansion, and he also brought up that they've been in all these, lived in all these areas before, so they're familiar with them, and he kind of feels like they have therefore a right to do that, and he is seeing Berlin. Right now in September 1941, he feels like things are going to go the way he has planned. It doesn't look like there's anything stopping it, and the success is going to take place, and he's seeing how it's going to be. So, you know, it must be feeling very good to him. Mm-hmm. You want to say anything more about that?
Just that last sentence there, Carolyn. Berlin must be the true center of Europe, a capital that for everybody shall be the capital. And of course, when World War II had ended and Germany was smashed and split into four units, and all the capital that the Germans were allowed wasn't Berlin. It was Bonn. I don't think that was by any particular accident or whatever. I think that was because of his thoughts. Berlin must be the true center of Europe, a capital that for everybody shall be the capital. And if there's anything, you know, associated with Hitler and National Socialism, it had to be totally erased.
Well, yeah, and after World War II, and even before it was over, they had determined that they would do this better than they did it after the First World War, and they wouldn't let a Hitler come up again, and so they made everything illegal, and they did everything terrible. I mean, what they did was beyond belief, really.
That's
people
exactly
don't
right.
always we forget. As said, you know, people are forgetful, and we forget how bad it was and how evil it was. So, and a lot of these people think that they Germans deserved it because they attacked. They think they were attacked, and so on, or they see it as themselves being attacked. And I guess they were in certain ways, but the Germans never treated anybody like these allies, and that includes the Russians treated. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a whole thing.
Oh right? Yeah, absolutely.
Oh God. All right, I'm going to go ahead. We've still got. We got 12 minutes, probably 11 minutes, but I'll start this out anyway. September 25th, 1941, this is in the evening, and he says, the myth of our vulnerability in the event of the war becoming prolonged must be resolutely discarded. It's impermissible to believe that time is working against us. Well, there you go. Already he's saying we're not ever going to give up, you know, on this. Mm-hmm. At present, my mind is occupied by two important problems. One, when I realize that a particular raw material is indispensable for the war, I shrink from no effort to make us independent in this field. We must be able to dispose freely of iron, coal, petroleum, grain, livestock, and timber. And two, economic life must be organized in terms of outlets situated in the territories we control. I may say that Europe is today an autarchy, but we have to prevent the existence of a gigantic state capable of using European civilization against us. Don't know exactly what he means by that. Our four-year plan is a very heavy blow to the English, for they felt that we had ceased to be vulnerable to blockade. They'd have offered to prepare me a loan in exchange for our giving up the plan. The four-year plan was ostensibly to prepare Germany for self-sufficiency in 4 years, and it started in 1936 and was to go to 1940. Continuing, it's easy to import when one is in a favorable situation. In the opposite event, one is hamstrung. The foreigner at once exploits the situation and blackmails one. How could we have paid for the wheat we'd have imported from America? Even for foodstuffs, it wouldn't work, and much less so as regards industrial products, meaning they couldn't be dependent on on these nations for, you know, buying things from them. They had to develop their own self-sufficiency. It would be a wise policy for Europe to give up the desire to export to the whole world. The white race, and here's the first time I've seen, I've ever seen him use this term, the white race, but he does. The white race has itself destroyed its world commerce. The European economy has lost its outlets in other continents. Our manufacturing costs prevent us from meeting foreign competition. Wherever it may be, we are so handicapped that it's impossible to gain a footing anywhere. For the few articles that foreigners still need, there's a cutthroat struggle between the suppliers. To gain access to these markets, one must pay such premiums that it represents a disproportionate effort for our economy. Only new inventions sometimes enable one to do a little business. To their misfortune, the English have industrialized India. Unemployment in England is increasing, and the English worker gets poorer. To think that there's the beginning of outsourcing, huh? To think that there are millions of unemployed in America, he's saying, wow. What should they do? What they should do there is to embark on a revolutionary new economic policy, abandon the gold standard, and further increase the needs of their home market. Germany is the only country that has no unemployment and that hangs together with the fact that we are not slaves to the need to export. Well, Germany is now slaves to the need to export, I have to say that. Mm-hmm. The country we are engaged in conquering, which he means Russia, will be a source of raw materials for us and a market for our products, but we shall take good care not to industrialize it, not to industrialize this country.
You want me to take it for a second here?
Yeah.
A paragraph or two?
Yeah.
Okay. The peasant is the being least of all accessible to ideologies. If I offer him land in Russia, a river of human beings will rush there headlong. For a man of the soil, the finest country is the one that yields the finest crops. In 20 years' time, European immigration will no longer be directed towards America, but eastwards. The Black Sea will be for us a sea whose wealth our fishermen will never exhaust. Thanks to the cultivation of the soybean, we'll increase our livestock. We'll win from that soil several times as much as the Ukrainian peasant is winning at present. Does that get to you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We'll be freed from the worry of having to seek outlets for our goods in the Far East. For our market is in Russia. We must make sure of it. We'll supply cotton goods, household utensils, and all the articles of current consumption. The need for them is so great that we shan't succeed in ourselves producing all that will be necessary. I see there the greatest possibilities for the creation of an empire of worldwide importance. In Russia.
Mm-hmm.
My plan is that we should take profits on whatever comes our way. But I insist on the fact that it's on our own soil that we must organize the production of whatever is vitally essential. The countries that work in harmony with us will be associated with all the positive contributions they can make. All deliveries of machines, even if they're made abroad, will have to pass through a German middleman in such a way that Russia will be supplied with no means of production whatsoever, except of absolute necessities. 2/3 of American engineers are German. During our centuries of life under particularist conditions, a great number of our compatriots were thrust back in upon themselves, and although they had the souls of leaders, they vegetated. When we can offer great tasks to such men, we'll be surprised to discover their immense qualities. For the next centuries, we have at our disposal an unequaled field of action. That's the end of that section.
Mm-hmm.
I think we better stop there, but we have a bit of time to talk about it. Mm-hmm. What do you have anything you want to comment on there?
Well, certainly the things that he says in that section there apply to the USA. NAFTA, shifting our what did you say a little bit ago? Over outsourcing, building factories and plants in Taiwan, enabling China, which is what we've done to develop industry, and what it's resulted in is unemployment in America, vulnerability. We don't make our own shoes anymore. We don't make so many things, and we have to import them. And that's exactly what Adolf Hitler is saying here, that Germany will avoid, to become self-sustaining, autarky. And if there's anything we need, we'll make it ourselves. And, of course, everything rings true. If you want your nation to progress and be profitable for all the people, you have to run it in that manner. When he brings it up there, it's on our own soil that we must organize the production of whatever is vitally essential. That negates any British blockade or any other nation that dares to try to embargo Germany. If you can produce it yourself, so what? If they think you can cut it off, they can't because you produce it yourself. So just a very good common sense approach to economics.
Well, and you know what strikes me is that, again, he's thinking totally about what's good for Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that would link up with, be similar to what we say today, that white people, we now talk about ourselves as white people, mm-hmm. but white people should do what's best for us. Well, let's just take it, Ray, to being Americans. People say, how do we organize in America? How do we do this? How do we do that? Well, maybe we should stop thinking of ourselves, as a part of the white race, and we all have to work together and we all have to help one another and so on. Because he wasn't thinking that way. He was thinking about what would be good for Germany. Mm-hmm. There was no concern about other races taking control of white countries, really, mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. What that has happened since then because he lost. But here we go, if we just think about America, if we just thought about what's good for us, period. We've been taught that America did that, and that's a horrible thing to do.
Because
we didn't care about other people, and you have to look after other people even more than yourself, unless you're going to be accused of being selfish and, all those things. So I think this is probably we probably need to get over a whole lot more than we think. You know, we just have this idea about not being concerned about caring about or not being afraid of being called a racist or something. Or
sure,
but we are afraid of being called other things like self-centered and pushy and bossy and pushing other people in the world around. This is the big thing against the United States today. Why are we supposed to be so hated? But we do have terrible leaders.
That's right.
Who we don't want these people doing it. We want people who are loyal Americans caring about America, not globalists.
Right.
But it's bringing up a lot of food for thought. If you accept what Adolf Hitler is saying is not something bad and evil, and just really think about it, there could be a lot of good suggestions for us, I think.
Most definitely.
All right. Well, here we are saying goodnight for another program. We got as far as I thought we would get,
mm-hmm.
so at least that. Here's our music, so goodnight, everybody.
Goodnight, folks. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for listening. Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour will return next week. exclusively on the White Network.